Welcome to a new edition of the Famous Interviews with Joe Dimino series. On this episode, we talk with Emmy Award-winning media advisor, Vinny Potestivo. He has over 25 years of experience launching some of the most notable talents, personal brands, and media franchises in modern pop culture. He is the host of I Have a Podcast. He enjoys talking about how he finds the best or worst in people and how to translate it in the media to get results. He spent some quality time with MTV overseeing some of the biggest changes and trends ever. He's got great stories. Enjoy this interview.
Hey, you know, when I read through your bio, I just couldn't shake the imagery of you being the wolf from Pulp Fiction. This is a guy who comes in and he's going to straighten it all out. You know, we got a situation. We need to be seen. And you're the guy. You come in, you got the suit, you're ready to go.
Winston, right? Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Man, I'll tell you what, with this Podmatch thing that I've been involved with, I've run into more Italians in this country than I think I have with my jazz program.
We do exist, by the way.
We're everywhere. It's like I come from this town right outside of Kansas City known as Liberty, Missouri, and I run into Liberty people all the time. It's like between Liberty and the Italians, it's like there's no way you're going to go anywhere, and there's not going to be a Kevin Bacon 6-degree scenario.
Well, you're describing what so now I can't get the picture out of my head other than My Blue Heaven, right? Isn't that when the Italians
Oh, escape? Yeah. Yeah. Totally.
And by the way, I'm from Staten Island. I live in Brooklyn now. My mom is from Wellington, like south of between Wichita and Oklahoma.
Wow.
So I absolutely can relate to what you. I spent my summers, you know, I spent like you know my 9 months a year here in New York talking about you gotta hit the cement hard, you know, and then I would spend 3 months in Kansas talking about that cement.
Man,
talking about being no longer Italian, but we are Italian. I was like, what?
Right? Yeah. You know, and it's weird. It's hot pavement in Kansas because it's starting to warm up. But, yeah, it's one of my favorite musicians of all time. His name is Jason Faulkner, and he was in the band Jellyfish in the 90s. And he used to spend his summers in Joplin, so I'm interviewing this guy. He's based in L.A., and it's like, there's this Midwest connection that people have. But real quick, my dad was born in Brooklyn. He was raised in Long Island, Babylon, Massapequa, and wanted to get the hell out of Dodge, so he joined the Air Force and came to Kansas City. So sometimes people are like, how the hell did a Dimino end up in Kansas City? And it was like, my dad was itching to get out of that place. So
yeah, I think my father, too. He got a scholarship, like some type of like sports scholarship, I think, at Kansas State, Emporia, Kansas State Teachers College, I think it was called back then.
Okay.
But we're Jayhawk fans. I think we're Jayhawk fans, I think.
you probably should be.
I don't know. Oh, yeah. I think everything I have, anything with a character on it is a Jayhawk. Anything with letters on it is Kansas City. So I know that.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. That's all you need to know. And since KU won the national championship, it's probably a good wagon to jump onto. Yeah.
Yeah. So. Hey, look, I'm in my household, there was two options, Yankees or Mets. So I'm like, I was a Mets fan. I'm a Nets Jets Mets fan. Imagine.
Yeah.
that growing up.
You got quite a triad. Yeah, I was a Mets fan when my dad, because he was from Long Island. So I remember in 86 when they won it, I ran outside. I twirled in the neighbor's yard like Jesse Orosco, and I threw my gloves so far in the air, I don't think I ever found it. So, and you know what was interesting? I watched the 30 for 30 and didn't realize how absolutely gonzo that team was. And a couple weeks later, so I interviewed Carl Fisher, who was Billy Joel's trumpeter, and he's like, yeah, we played the last show at Shea and the first show at the new stadium. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, oh my God, dude. Like the stories that he had of like Paul McCartney flying in to JFK, he got a special entourage there, and he plays and kind of completes the proverbial circle. It was like, wow, that's amazing.
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
One of my close friends married Lenny Dykstra's son, Cutter Dykstra.
That's
so cool.
Yeah,
I got to meet Daryl Strawberry once. I got to meet him like about 15 years ago.
What was that like?
Oh, it was so cool because it was Rock and Jock. It was like a Rock and Jock music festival thing that we did on MTV. So I would use that, you know. When I got that job at MTV, it was like I can make any phone call I want, and anyone will answer, and they'll come see me. Like, that's really how this job works. Like, this is my job title. It's like, you call celebrities and see if they want to do TV shows, and you get them in, and you, that's my job? Okay.
That's all wild.
Right. That's what you say. But like, I use that. I mean, I got to meet such awesome people. And when people talk about taking advantage of living in New York, they often talk about, like, going to see Broadway shows or something like that. And I certainly do. But I also take advantage of New York by being an extra in certain media properties that I feel really passionate about, where I kind of, like, go low-key and I don't want anyone to know that I'm, like, even on the other side of the industry. I want them to know nothing about me. I just show up on set as a hired extra. And I got to be in Just Like That with Sarah Jessica Parker for the last season, which is cool, because I was also in Sex and the City the first time around they shot it. And I got to be in, I just forgot it, Martin Scorsese and De Niro, The Irishman. I got to be in The Irishman. And I'm like, that's like a bunch of, you know, those, like, there's like a big New York Italian moment. It's like if you're an actor and you come through New York and you don't hit NCIS or one of those, like, you know, true crime procedurals that they shoot here. We want that as like a badge of honor, you know.
Yeah, without a doubt. You know, I saw a movie one time about extras. It was all about focusing on it. So I am one of those guys that when I look at movies, I'm always looking at the extras to see how they're interacting and if they're looking, if they get caught looking at the lead actor and just how they do it, because it's fascinating how much goes into it. I don't think the regular person understands how much and how many people work on a movie set.
No, that's the wonder, especially for modern creators who, to be honest, qualify to be a creator by way of technology, not by way of training or experience or projects or blunders that, you know, creatives generally go through before they identify as being creative. You know, once we got the iPhone in our hands, you know, legitimately there was millions of instant creators. And I think that's one of those things that they're not trained to deal with. And I think I love helping people who are sort of newly identifying as creators, people who, business owners who are trying to use social media or personal media like podcasts, narrowcasts, or the public media like broadcast and digital streaming. I like helping sort of those new voices in the mix. But I think that stems from starting off at MTV and like liking, I like being the first. I like being people's first. I was a casting director, not a recasting director. I didn't get to go around recasting all the famous people that were already on TV, like a lot of my, no disrespect to my fellow casting director friends. But the search is different. And they're actually delivering exactly what the network wants now, those bona fide stars. But those people didn't exist. And we got to create them at MTV in the late 90s, early 2000s. Like that was like a gift. I had no clue what a gift that would be.
Without a doubt. Well, and the one thing I want to do is, before I work back to how all this began for you, growing up, how you kind of got this seed and motivation to do what you do, explain to me exactly what you do, like your title and what you actually do.
I help people stand out. I help people of impact make impact, to be honest. Some of them are famous. Some of them are businesses. Some of them run businesses. Some of them our brands, some of them run brands, but I think what I do is I help people stand out. I helped in the late 90s, early 2000s at MTV. I did that, you know, with a ton of celebrity talent that, you know, went on to change the landscape of what I think is sort of modern pop culture. Mandy Moore, Ashton Kutcher, Ashley Simpson, Jessica Simpson, the Osbournes. I got to be in the room with some amazing talent and see it happen in real life. It was part of those development conversations and production conversations and troubleshooting conversations, and it was so cool to get to experience that. I learned how to build talent brands for the first 10 years of my career, and then I think for the last 15, I've been getting, you know, entrepreneurs and business owners on television, or in mass media, I should say. So whether that's by casting their Housewives of New Jersey, you know, my way of finding, you know, business owners who could be on television in a sustainable period, on a long period of time, or other TV shows, like The Challenge, you know, getting TJ Lavin, the hosting spot on The Challenge, I think 38 seasons ago, whatever, however many challenges they've recorded since then. But getting that sort of person in there in a sustainable way, helping Nick Cannon bring Wildin' Out to MTV, get Wildin' Out created through development, and then what Nick ultimately ended up, you know, doing with it, which has impacted culture, let alone the network. I love that sustainable level of creativity. I've been exposed to budgets, large and small, distribution channels, mostly large, broadcasts more so than narrow casts and podcasts. And that's the part that I think I get most excited about now. Because I remember in the late 90s when I was the 20-something year old who knew how to digitize VHS and beta to, you know, to hard drives, and was able to, without you know, ruining, or while preserving, I should say, quality. And I'm seeing that happening now again, and especially with creativity, helping people come up with ways to not burn out. There's like, there's reasons why TV shows last years and years and years, and late night shows last years and years and years, you know. Actually, that's actually the first thing. Can I talk about that for a second? Because it's the first thing. You know, these late night shows, what they've done right. If anything, we learn any podcaster listening to this should learn anything from any of the late night shows. It's to create a show full of segments. Segments are what keep the creativity sustainable. They put immediacy to the conversation. They force you to be value driven and cut through some of the ums and uhs and ways that we like to fill space. And allows people to, you know, move quickly. And I think that we can learn a lot from the current late night talk show wars, so to speak. Especially as Jimmy Fallon and Jimmy Kimmel and James Corden, they all have Ellen, they all have little segments that became their own TV shows. Like, this is the future of podcasting. This is the future of narrow casting and micro casting and social casting, and just if anything, if you get anything out of this conversation, it's just to start thinking about conversations and segments. That's sort of like what I want to make sure it gets out there today.
Absolutely. I totally see that. So, you know, you're obviously very highly motivated. You're doing some high-powered things in your life. Talk to me about your childhood. How did you get this desire in you to do what you do with your life?
That's awesome. It's a defense mechanism. I think like most good creatives would admit. I didn't grow up having cable, but I grew up in a single parent household as a child, going through Al-Anon and Al-Ateen because of my parents and their addictions, and some of the choices that were made for me that I didn't get to make for myself. And to be really, I'm the oldest of four. And I think I learned how to make things happen for my brothers and my sister that were fulfilling to me. And I think that I learned how to tell the same story. You know, the facts don't change and the characters don't change, but the story is going to change depending on if I'm telling the story to my grandma or my friends or my brother Joey or my younger sister Nicole. The story is going to change. And I think that was a really cool skill set that I learned just as a storyteller, about how to sculpt and shape stories, short form, long form, for different audiences. That I mean, if you look at my 25-year career in television, I started off at MTV before reality TV was a genre. It's a genre. I got to MTV and I was casting Beyonce in her first film and brought Mandy Moore to help bring Mandy Moore to the team, and was part of a team that was like pioneering scripted talent moves, and kind of hosts and scripted, but none of this unscripted stuff until we'll talk about it later. But until the big boom happened that ultimately I felt was a big calling for me. And then my senior year in college, I did something called the Landmark Forum. Are you familiar with this, the Landmark Forum?
Yes.
So I did a landmark form in the month of September, and then in October I went back to school and I decided I was going to be a casting director. So I took out an ad backstage, and then I got, I'm a casting director looking to stock my files with actors looking to be cast in future commercials. So I had to word it in a way where I was like, I'm not exactly qualified. Don't expect anything from me, but I am looking to build my files. I had no clue what that meant, but I just knew that that was my first step into being in casting. And I think I got over 500 submissions sent to me at school. It was like my Macy's Santa Claus moment, you know, like they do, like when I come into the USPS has like five of those giant boxes full of like 8x10 headshots for me. The Wagner College team is like, Vinny, what did you do? And then like the tech part of me, like the sort of introvert, I was a digital creator, creating web pages and playing with fonts and I was happy to be creating on a computer. Computers for me were our quiet space, actually. So I could be at my house as a teen on a computer with everything else around me, and no one's going to come in, and unless they unplug my computer, you know, or did something that broke the computer, no one's going to come in and ruin, you know, my book isn't going to go missing, and the dog isn't going to eat my homework, and no one's going to spill anything on my this, and I have a space to create. And I think that that's kind of like, that's what I picked up on as a kid, was to create in that white space. Well, actually for me, it was a black screen with a green blinking cursor. And I loved being able to program in a space that was like, I felt almost like I was creating more space and I didn't have to go anywhere for that. I bring that lesson with me all the way through reality TV, because reality TV for me was a result of knowing that people tell themselves the worst version of their own story. I learned this in Landmark Forum. I left Landmark Forum. I said, stop saying what you want to do, just be what you want to be, but don't do it. Don't be a liar. So you got to go. I had a problem with that. You know, people who say, just believe where you want to, just talk as if like it's already happening, you know, a year from now, and, you know, use words that are current and not future. And I was like, I have a problem with that. You're skipping the reality piece. So the life piece that gets into reality. And I realize that I can't control reality. I can control some of the actions and choices that I make in my life. And if those are recorded or if those are seen and shared, then that would change the perception of my life, which is your version of reality. So I thought that was a really powerful lesson to learn and breakthrough, personal breakthrough to have. My boss, Rod Asa, sat down with Sharon Osbourne and came up with Osbournes, and he pioneered unscripted television. It was he and I who created the talent development department at MTV. So I owe so much of what I got to experience to just his innovative way of being a storyteller. But I know, I don't want to say this carefully, I know he and I did not have, you know, the most ideal childhoods. And we learned how a story could help shape opinions or the outcome of life. And I think that's what I got to be a part of at MTV. And I wasn't the person you came and pitched the TV show to, because that's just not how it worked back then. I was the guy that was calling. I was either out at night trying to meet people in real life, you know, between 12 a.m. and 4 a.m. in New York City. There's a lot to be said about amount of contact and business I made directly from those relationships. Just being out at a nightclub dancing and being with Wade Robson for that night, and then saying, Wade, we don't have a dance show. You should have a dance show on MTV. We don't even know what it's called, but just call it the Wade Robson Project and let's keep dancing on MTV. Like, we used to have dance shows, but we don't have them. Like, what a great way in. And I got to be a part of like weird, cool conversations like that move the needle. They move the needle in terms of
the conversation or in terms of community representation. They moved the needle. And then I saw MTV make more and more space. I talk about creating space. But MTV got rid of videos because they were taking up too much damn space. And they gave us 30 minutes to tell the story of Newlyweds, 30 minutes to tell the story of this crazy family called the Osbournes that, you know, is so dysfunctional, but they somehow make it work. And, like, they're so relatable, even though they're unrelatable, you know. And the MTV gave us space for that. And then the audience came. And then MTV would re-air. I think we re-air every episode in cable about, like, 50-plus times. So that was fun to go through. But we were, I was part of the MTV era. Yeah, not an error. I was part of the MTV era that didn't have, like, there, you know, sometimes at, like, 2 a.m., then it goes to, like, local programming, and, like, you can buy kind of, like, local TV, or you see those bars come. Like, I was part of the MTV after UMTV Raps, where there was pretty much 24/7 original programming produced by MTV. I had no clue even what a production company was. In 2007, when I left MTV, I was like, I don't get production companies. Like, everyone works at MTV. We produce everything here. But then what's the production company part? And then to be honest, I think it's Apple. Apple and the iPhone and technology had a lot to do with how production companies were able to finally be created outside of the infrastructure of what MTV and Viacom was providing for them. But with that, you know, MTV got to own all those stories and still does own those stories. And that's what I think I'm so passionate about with podcasting now, is you own it. You don't ever, ever sell your podcast. Own it for life. License it and co-op it. And, you know, I can give you lots of ways to make money off of the actual content itself, the actual, you know, file. I can show you lots of ways to make money and to continue not just repurposing, but finding purpose for that content, but it all stems from ownership. And I'm so, it's cool that we live in America. It's cool that we live in a time where we can create something and own it. It just, that's just not how the creative market ever worked. So
yeah, for sure. You know, of all of the things you mentioned, MTV, and there's a lot of things that you've mentioned that you've done. What are you the proudest of? What stands out as something that you think, wow, I was a part of that?
Oh, that's a, I love, does it have to be about back then, or can it be, can I use now as an example as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I want to say I have a pod, the thing we're doing with I Have a Podcast, it started off as a podcast for me, with a partnership with Bespoke TV. We now have a syndicated television show that airs on a couple of AVODs and cable networks programmatically, Cox, Comcast, DirecTV. We were able to get it registered and have turned ihaveapodcast.com into a platform for podcast discovery, where I'm helping independent podcasters get original press that helps with your journey on verification on social platforms and so forth. I'm also bringing brands and sponsors to podcasters the same way that brands are meeting influencers on creator platforms. And I think all of that is an amalgamation of all the experiences that I had from being on TRL. I mean, I got to work on a hit show for 10 years of my career, right out of the gate. You know, that's not normal. And by the way, a couple of hit shows right out of the gate in my 20s is certainly not normal an experience. And I got to see great strides and growth, and I got to see really horrible, devastating career, you know, overnight, you know, career crashes. I'm thinking about that SNL moment when Ashley Simpson didn't know how to recover from a certain song, and like, how did I just show? Or seeing, you know, being part of Nipplegate, the Janet Jackson, Justin Timberlake Nipplegate thing that happened at MTV that changed, you know, programming overnight for us. Like, so many shows got tweaked because of what happened there. In that one instance of us, you know, growing as a brand. I love my time at MTV, though. Because I was one of two people who, with my boss, Rod Asa, and I, as his assistant, created a talent development department. I got to write, like, the SOP for how the department was run and operated and how we would allocate time and money to identifying emerging talent and where that talent was culled from. And that experience helped me create talent development departments for dozens of production companies, hundreds of businesses that have creative business, that have creative company, creative, sorry, that have creative departments, or smaller agencies within the, you know, they're not identified as creative companies, but they need creative license to be able to, you know, connect and utilize social and some of the other mainstream media. So I love helping people find that foundational support in creativity. That's like kind of cool. And then I like throwing it all away and saying, I know too much. Let me just pick up my iPhone. Let me just like plug in and like record and not worry about it being so damn special. But I can be concise. And I can, you know, just make sure that what's being talked about is enforceable, you know, not just theoretical. And that, to me, that's important.
So who would you consider a hero?
Oh, wow. I would consider, I mean, there's so many different ways to sort of answer this question. I kind of feel like in interpreting your question as like a hero in terms of like being a creative hero, and someone who inspires, you know, creativity, someone who, well, that's a really great, I don't know why I'm so stumped at this. Who's a hero? I mean, there's so many of us, that are out there, and we're all inspired by so many people. And I think we all, it's the unsung heroes for me. It's the people who identify now as the underdogs. I just laughed because I remember a time and date when Beyonce was considered the underdog. It's those people that my heroes are my audience. I do this thing on LinkedIn on Thursdays at 4 p.m. Eastern. So if anyone who's listening wants to ever find me, that's where you can find me on LinkedIn. I do this live audio. All those people in my room, those are my heroes. They're how they're saving the energy, the work. It's not about even like making me show up, but what they're doing with what we're creating is on that level of inspiring. And I never thought that as a community, as a decentralized community, that was capable. There was always, I felt like something that centralized the community to be able to make that level of impact. And I think that's sort of my final answer.
Yeah, no, I like it. So what's been one of the best fan experiences that you've had? Any feedback, running into anybody that you've ever got that's kind of blown you away that you always remember?
Yeah, I mean, the funny part about what I did at MTV is I kind of felt like the best side of everybody. Everyone was, you know, not to say always on their best behavior, but like I was definitely in the room and able to help, you know, support conversations. So there have been some fun story. I don't even know what's been told and what hasn't been shared yet. I don't know. I think that I don't know why I'm stuttering so much. I'm trying to see if I want to go good or bad on this one, but I think one of the best experiences I ever had was with Dave Matthews. We did, I'll never forget it because it was the last Unplugged that at the MTV studio let the employees drink in. It was that rowdy that after that Unplugged that we recorded in the studio, after that day, there was an email that went around saying, moving forward, you know, crew and MTV staff will no longer be allowed to drink, you know, in the studio. I just had the coolest moments that also, by the way, I feel like sharing this. Like the first thing I had a cat, this is weird. You think about like how do you end up being the guy who casts DJs or finds, you know, celebrities to do the TV shows? Here's where you start. I had to cast the audience that was in like some like Blink 182 naked bike. They did a naked bike race in the studio, and I had to get 20 people in the studio that didn't know it was going to happen. And then the guys, you know, ran around. They biked around the studio naked. And I remember being like, "Oh man, I just invited my friends to this, and now these like people with these like this band is running around naked. This feels like so it's a misuse of talent. Maybe I didn't quite understand it." And then the next call I got was to help them with the audience for the Tom Green show, and I'll never forget the day that I realized I don't want my family to come to any more MTV tapings for a while. I was like, what am I signed up for? I've come from, like, I worked on Hannity and Combs and on some Food Network shows. Like, I was kind of good at the database thing, you know? I was kind of good at creating databases and email lists and finding people and keeping them organized and reaching out to them with information and in a mass way, and then remembering a couple of people along the way that, you know, maybe I would recommend to be like the contestant on the episode, or maybe they should ask the question if we go to the audience. And like, it was that level of curiosity that kind of, like, you know, that got me in there. And I came into TV knowing how to digitize content. And that was always something that, like, and I was always identified as like a tech. Like, people would be like, "Vinny, can you cast this show? We need two VJs for this. And also, can you fix my email?" Because, like, it was not, that was not an awkward sentence for me to get a request.
Let me ask you this. You know, everyone, obviously, you've been in different incarnations. Everyone has a perception of you, your family, your friends, your colleagues. But you live your life. What's your perception? Who do you think you are?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. I think I'm a work in progress. I think I'm still as curious now as I was then. I think that I'm still quick to take action, slow to change my mind, something that I look for in collaborators as well, people who know what their point of view is but also understand that there's room for growth. That's a nice place to be versus, you know, people who knew me in my 20s where I felt I would, you know, I think in therapy even refer to myself as like MTV Vinny, because I felt like a version of myself, a level of bravado and a personal sense of style that, you know, I was picking up on from cues from other people. You know, there's a part of me in my 20s that finally wanted to be accepted and liked after the version of me in my teens that was, you know, well, you don't know, but was so bullied and not connected with a larger audience that I would, you know, I would be late to school. I would be late to class because if I'm late to class, then I'm not going to run into anybody in front of the building that's going to want to pick on me, or anyone in the hallways that's going to want to pick on me. I can just walk into class and no one's going to be able to talk to me. So, like, there's like that version, that 17-year-old version. The 27-year-old version, which is, you know, it's a fun version of MTV where I'm finally in a place where of opportunity, where I'm able to share levels of opportunity that are just like way bigger than me. Like, I could not even claim to be part of the opportunities I've represented, but I was the tiny little piece at the bottom of that funnel. That was me that got to pick, you know, point where those opportunities went. And I realized that when I was about 27, that the decisions we were making on MTV were creating stars that were fighting for, was creating stars like Mandy Moore that were fighting for my right to marry who I could marry and have families with, you know, like this. That it was a much bigger thing than what you were doing there. And now, and then, and by ironically, that if people who meet me just in my 40s, they'll know me coming out of my what's it called when you don't think you should, when you don't think you're qualified to do something, and you have like these minimizing thoughts. That's a word. I'm glad I blocked it out of my vocabulary.
Yeah.
But, you know, this thing where I didn't think, you know, I was qualified or I should be doing what I'm doing, and I'm questioning, you know, the services and the impact and you know, just the rhetoric of it all. But I'm glad I'm through that. Podcasting helped me with that, for sure. Podcasting helped me. So the best thing about podcasting
for me was not creating my podcast episodes. Is this what we're doing right now? Is the guesting? Is getting to meet people now that I'm considered a podcaster and I can be in the podcast space? It's like, here's my voice. This is what it's taking for me to qualify for myself to show up, you know, in this capacity, which is not necessary, by the way. Like I didn't have to go the long way, but I did. So I'm sorry if I'm too descriptive when it comes to the scenic route.
No, I like it. I actually prefer that. So Vinny, if anybody wants to listen to your podcast, learn more about you and what you do, where should they go? What should they do?
Oh, that's awesome. IHaveAPodcast.com is the best place to link up with me for anything podcast related, whether you're looking for a new podcast or you'd like to hear any of the new episodes I've got coming out. VPE.tv is my website, 5 little letters, VPE.tv. I do offer a free membership to my Creator Accelerator, where I have lists of digital awards that you probably aren't aware of, and platforms that are offering credits that you probably aren't aware of, and ways to monetize your brand, monetize your content, and I'm just giving that information away for free through our Creator Accelerator. So I'm excited to link up with people who are interested in getting that type of support.
Beautiful. Vinny, man, it was great to catch up with you. Thank you for opening up, giving me your story. It's been wonderful, man. Good luck with everything.
Hey, Joe. Thanks much.
Thanks for tuning in to another famous interview with Joe Domino, where we cover the world of art, literature, and music around the globe. Most of the music on these episodes comes from Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino in the iTunes Store. You can see these on the Neon Jazz YouTube channel. And for everything Joe Domino related, go to JoeDomino.com. And when you're there, you can donate via PayPal or Patreon to keep all of this going. Until next time.